Professor Angi, thank you so much for agreeing to be interviewed for the Eminent Scholars Archive. We do like to do a contemporary reflection on the faculty and
Oh,
the
yes.
Goodhart, the Goodhart chairs. We do interviews with those who hold the Goodhart chair to reflect the current activity of the faculty and the current scholarship. So thank you very much for agreeing to talk to us. I just thought by way of beginning, we could get a bit of a sense of your career before coming to Cambridge.
Great.
And I have read your recent article where you're rethinking international law, a Twelve retrospective. And I didn't know if that would be a good place to start or if you'd like to
As good
start
as
here.
anywhere. No, that's fine. So.
So I was wondering if you could tell us about your activities with that organization, or how you came to it, and or were you one of the founders of the organization? Well, of TWEL too, as it were.
Historical origins are always complicated,
Right.
isn't it?
Yes.
So,
Yes.
and as a historian yourself, I think you'd appreciate this. So we don't even call ourselves an organization.
Right.
We call ourselves a network of scholars. And it's one of the interesting things about third world approaches to international law, or TWEL, that people seem to have an idea of TWEL as an organization, which has a leadership and which has members. And which has units. So it sees us as some kind of a think tank or NGO, hierarchy and structure. But we are none of those things. It is just a group of scholars who are interested in these issues of the third world and international law, and the way in which the third world has been largely excluded from the making of international law. Historically, that has been the case.
Yes.
And it's interesting. I mean, walking up the steps to come to this office, you'd have seen many eminent Cambridge scholars, such as John Westlake and Lasse Oppenheim, who were instrumental in making sure that non-European people were excluded from international law. They wrote very powerfully about how these people were uncivilized. And because they were uncivilized, they were not properly sovereign. And of course, international law is all about sovereigns. So, if you're not sovereign, you can't participate in the making of international law. You're simply an object in the system, rather than a subject which can participate in the making of international law. So, those are the issues that we were interested in, on the relationship between imperialism and international law, and how that has been understood, and the ongoing effects of imperialism. Because one of the claims that we would make is that the structures of disempowerment that emerge from imperialism continue to be a very prominent feature of contemporary international law. So there's a group of us at Harvard who were interested in this issue. And we drew upon the work of a very distinguished group of scholars. And this is something that I try to highlight in my article as well. There's always been efforts by non-European scholars to engage with international law in this very difficult situation where international law has been traditionally used to conquer non-European people or to suppress them, even when they are independent. So the article tries to give some sense of what TWEL scholars have been working on and what inspires them, and also reflect on the fact that to the extent we can say there was an origin, it was a conference organized in 1997 by basically graduate students at Harvard. James Gathie has written a wonderful article. He was one of those scholars. He played a very prominent role in this, and Vasuki Nesiah, Balakrishnan Rajagopal, and a number of other scholars, and inspired also by B.S. Chimney, who happened to be, he's a very distinguished Indian scholar who was at Harvard at the time. It was a group of these people who organized this conference in 1997. And I suppose it's something of a cliche in international law, isn't it, that everything is supposed to begin with the conference.
Yes.
You know, the Peace of Westphalia, or you could say the League of Nations, you know, Versailles. But anyway, 1997. So I wrote that article, you know, something like 25 years later.
Right.
And I think when that conference was held, we never dreamt that this would become such a presence in the world of international law. And it was an attempt to assess that. And I should say it was just a personal attempt, because my other colleagues and those who were involved in organizing that conference have written about this extensively, and I want to keep pointing this out so that people would get a sense of the range of ways in which this subject has been treated.
Mm. Yes, yes. And then there were responses written to your introduction, weren't there? So it's a very lively and active group of scholars.
Yes, I think so. It's one of the wonderful things I feel about TWAIL, that there are new generations of scholars who are contesting what we said. I feel I am a TWAIL scholar of a particular generation, and the wonderful thing is that we have many other scholars from all over the world who are, you know, challenging what my generation was arguing, and they're taking up you know, these issues in their own way and adding new ones to them. And so that, I think, is something that we never dreamt of, really, when we held that first conference in 1997.
And I was wondering if you would be, if you could tell us a bit about your role as the Secretary General of the Asian Society of International Law. Because you were Secretary General for quite a long time.
Yes. So I was fortunate enough to be involved in the Asian Society of International Law from its beginnings, as it were, when we were drafting a constitution.
Right. Okay.
And Professor Onuma from the University of Tokyo and Judge Owada Hisashi, who was a very eminent judge in the International Court of Justice, really took the initiative to create an Asian Society of International Law, because no such society was in existence. I mean, there was the American Society and Latin American Society, and there was, of course, the European Society. And there were efforts made in various ways by other Asian scholars, Christopher Pinto, Ko Swan Swick. You know, they established a foundation for the development of international law in Asia. So there were these initiatives that were taking place. But it goes back to the basic point that I made earlier, which is that there was a sense that international law had been largely created by European scholars, whose vision had then been presented as universally valid. And the feeling was that Asia needed to develop its own voice in the international arena, and the Asian Society of International Law was one way of doing that.
And then through the journal as well, because you remain co-editor of the Asian Journal of International Law?
Yes, with my colleagues, Simon Chesterman and Tan Shen Li, who are based in Singapore.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned before, when talking about TWAIL, about walking up the stairs past those photographs,
yes.
of individuals that we can read about in your scholarship. And I, one of the things I wondered, you seem to have had an association with Cambridge for quite a long time, going back quite a long time in your career.
Yes. well, lots of associations of different types of association. So it's something I mentioned in the Goodhart lecture, which I gave in March, that it was always my father's ambition to send me to study in Cambridge.
Oh, right.
because he came here in 1949. Sri Lanka had just become independent. It was called Ceylon at that time. And he came to England for his training, and he visited all these institutions and traveled. And it was Cambridge which made a huge impression on him. So after that, you know, when I was born, he wanted me to, or had in the back of his mind, this idea that I should study in Cambridge. And there was a moment when I was at university when it seemed that I wouldn't achieve the first that was thought to be the basis of a scholarship. You know, you had to get a first to get the scholarship that would enable you to study in Cambridge. And I had to decide between writing a fairly safe thesis, which would have a good chance of getting a first, or writing a more challenging and problematic thesis, which ran the risk of not getting a first. And my father said, it's all right. If you don't take the risk, do the challenging thesis. And if you don't get a first, I'll sell the house to send you to Cambridge. So that's how much it meant to him.
But well, so encouraging of you to take the risk.
Well, it's something I felt I had to do at that time. You know, when you're young, you feel, if I have these goals and ambitions, I need to be able to convince myself that I'll meet these challenges, because that's going to be a situation I'll be finding myself in continuously if I want to do interesting work. So it was personal in that sense as well. I suppose I had to prove myself to myself.
Right. And then in your work on the Commission of Inquiry, you mentioned in your introduction to your monograph that there were that there were Cambridge lawyers involved in that as well, or you watched them at the ICJ.
Yes. I mean, I suppose this whole question of connections and coming to a place that as deeply aware of, because of course Oxbridge had a particular significance in Ceylon, as it would have in all former colonies.
Yes.
It becomes a sort of mythical place in various ways, so there was that image of the place as well. And so it seemed quite astonishing to be able to think of myself coming here. And the person you're really thinking of is, the person I mentioned is James Crawford.
Yes.
And, you know, here we are in the office that was James Crawford's.
Oh, right.
So this is interesting set of connections and circumstances. He was asked by the government of Nauru for his opinion about whether Nauru had a legal case to bring in the International Court of Justice. I worked for my mentor, in many ways my hero, Professor Christopher Weeramanthri, who was the chair of a commission of inquiry established by the government of Nauru to look into this question of whether Australia and England and New Zealand owed reparations to Nauru for the damage that had been caused by these three countries that had administered Nauru. So it becomes a bit technical here, but Nauru was a mandate created by the League of Nations, and the three partner governments who acted as mandatory were Australia, New Zealand, and England. And the whole idea of the mandate system was to protect the interests of the native people. But these three countries proceeded to mine out phosphates, causing massive environmental devastation. And so that was the foundation of this inquiry, this commission of inquiry. So Professor Weeramanthri wrote this massive, I can't remember how many volumes it was, but 10, 12 volumes, and huge numbers of exhibits as well. I was his research assistant, getting the information and, you know, going over the drafts and researching the law and so on. And then we produced this report, and the question was, would this be the foundation of a case? Now, the Commission of Inquiry and Judge he became a judge on the International Court of Justice, but to me he's always Professor Veeramanthri.
Yes.
He provided all the evidence and many of the arguments. And so James Crawford then was consulted by the government of Nauru. And James Crawford, who was at that time, I believe he was still in Australia. And Ian Brownlee, very prominent lawyer, the Cicelli professor at Oxford at the time, and James Crawford's supervisor, was also consulted about this issue. So that's how I met James Crawford, who was very kind to me because I was a research assistant, you know, rushing up and down trying to find the papers that they were requesting while they sat in this massive room trying to sort through all the materials and documents. So that was, you could say, the beginnings of a connection with Cambridge in that other way.
Yes, because then your monograph was published as part of the series in International Law, the Cambridge series, wasn't it?
Yes, and it was not without struggles,
right.
Because the reviewers rejected my manuscript twice. And the second time was quite crushing because after I received the first rejection, I spent another 4 years revising in the way that was suggested by the reviewer. And I thought I had addressed all the issues, but then it was rejected again, even more emphatically, which seemed odd to me at the time.
Yes.
Well, they said encouraging things like, in a very Oxbridge way, you know, this is a this is a good effort, and you know, the writer should be commended, and that type of, it's a very Oxbridge type of language, isn't it?
Right.
I'm trying to become familiar with that very, you know, specific vocabulary, which outsiders think they share, but which they don't really.
Yes, absolutely.
Because there's a very sort of Oxbridge way of using the word. Interesting.
Mm.
How interesting. And so much depends on the tone, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, absolutely.
In these circumstances.
Absolutely.
And what they really mean to say when they call something interesting is, this is ridiculous. But anyway, so I think this is where James really played a role, because he was general editor of the series.
Yes.
And so when it was rejected the second time, I think he had a look at it himself.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a sympathy for my argument because it was based on the Nauru case, which
yes.
was his first case in the International Court of Justice. So he had a long and extraordinarily distinguished career arguing before the court and doing so much, so many other things. And so he had a sympathy with my argument, I think, because it was also based on Nauru,
mm-hmm.
which was his first case. So then it was reviewed yet again, and this time I got through, and so it was published. But then it was also a struggle to get it issued in paperback.
Right.
Because I had to convince Cambridge that it was worth being published in paperback. And CUP asked me to get letters from various scholars attesting to the fact that they would be prescribing my book to their class.
Yes, yes.
So it wasn't a very comfortable situation. But it was issued in paperback. And who knows, Cambridge might even be pleased now that they published it finally.
Yes, yes. Well, I would have thought so. So, and do you think it was the nature of the argument that was really the issue,
it's a very good question. It's a very good question. You know, when it was rejected the first time, I actually accepted pretty much all the criticisms because I knew that I had an interesting argument, but I needed to substantiate it.
Yes.
But I spent a lot of time and effort substantiating it. Now, it's true that my goals were somewhat ambitious, you could say, you know, beginning with a scholar who was working in the 1530s and going all the way to... Well, I kept adding chapters, I suppose, because, you know, international developments were unfolding and the Iraq War had taken place and so forth. And so it, the sweep, I suppose, was quite extensive because it begins with Vittoria, who was a Dominican priest whose lectures were delivered in the 1520s or 1530s. And then the story ended with Iraq, the war in 2003. So I accepted the initial review's criticisms. But then when it was rejected the second time, I really felt there's something else going on. And it does have something to do with the argument I'm making.
Right, yes.
Which was, I'm not quite sure what word we should use here now. Challenging, provocative. Anyway. But the odd thing is that once the book came out, people said, well, of course, he's absolutely right.
Yes. Right.
In fact, it's obvious. I mean, it's just something that we all knew about. So I think one of the best compliments I receive is when people say, yes, but that's obvious.
Right, yes.
So that was a sort of affirmation. So that was, now it's 25 years, I think, since it came out.
Yes.
No, 20 years.
20 years. So you came to Cambridge this year to take up the Goodhart Chair. And I was curious sort of why now, or had you considered it earlier, or are you at a point in your research, or perhaps just family circumstance that now is the time to come?
Just in terms of the background to the Goodhart, so it's a very distinguished chair, so I'm very honored to hold it. It's not a chair one applies for. So completely out of the blue, Cambridge invited me to hold the position. And I have to say, I wasn't sure whether to take it up at the time. Because I spent half the year in Singapore at the National University of Singapore and half the year at the University of Utah. And there was just and neither is happy at the fact that I'm spending 6 months in the other institution. I think that it's fair enough to say that.
Yes.
But they've both been very generous to me and they've allowed me to maintain that arrangement. And then there was the question of, and now I'm going to ask them for a year off to come to Cambridge. You know, the other thing, of course, was it meant a lot to my father because I didn't fulfill his ambitions because I didn't go to Cambridge. I went to the other place. Oh, I suppose I should say the other Cambridge. The other place is normally Oxford, isn't it?
Yes.
I went to the other place in Massachusetts. Yes. I went to that other place in Massachusetts.
Harvard, yes.
And I thought, that should satisfy Dad, but it didn't because even after I'd become a professor, we were watching TV together one day and he looked up from the newspaper that he was browsing and said, oh, look, there's a Chevening scholarship. You could apply to go to Cambridge. So this is after I'd got tenure. And I thought, my career was, well along the way. But he made it clear that as far as he was concerned, I'd gone to that inferior Cambridge.
Right, yes.
So in an odd way, I was doing it partly because of that ambition he had. But of course, it's a huge honor. And Cambridge is an extraordinary university. And I must say, now that I'm here, I really feel it corresponds with my idea of what a great university should be, just in terms of the atmosphere and the way the institution is set up and the amazing people one meets here, the beautiful setting, I think it all contributes, and the very rich intellectual cultural life. And of course, the Lauterpacht Center for International Law. I mean, Cambridge, one of its real strengths is its international law faculty. And historically, that has always been the case, even though I disagree.
Well, this one, I wondered, how did it feel to come up those stairs past those photographs of the people that you're challenging in your scholarship?
I thought, well, it's interesting that how history, I suppose, works out. I mean, here I am in the same institution, which gave them so much recognition. And let me just say that they were brilliant scholars. I make that distinction.
Yes.
I mean, John Westlake, who said the most derogatory things about non-European people, was a very decent man. He cared about women's rights. He cared about, working class education. He was a fellow at Trinity. And so I'm really interested in this issue of how one can be completely decent and one can win all these accolades. Accolades, I think, in this case, I mean, there's one part of scholarship where you win accolades because you represent your times. So in such a powerful way, and you articulate your time in such an eloquent way. And people discover themselves in your writing. So he reflected the thinking of the time, Victorian England, and their views of non-European peoples and so forth. So there is one way of winning accolades by being utterly establishment,
yes,
and simply, even while appearing perhaps to be radical.
Right.
But what you're doing is just reflecting the sentiment, perhaps not articulated with quite the precision that your training has allowed you to articulate it. And so it's this interesting thing of right now. I mean, here we are in Cambridge on this beautiful summer afternoon, and the sunlit garden and the wind in the trees, and massive violence is taking place just a few hours flight away from us.
Yes.
So I'm interested in this idea of how these people can produce these ideas which have massive consequences, which they don't seem to contemplate.
Right.
And which doesn't disturb their sense of being, and they were, in many respects, pillars of the community. Now, it has to be said for John Westlake that he didn't have the advantage of TikTok and YouTube to see the consequences or the implications of the positions he was taking and what was happening out there in Africa.
Mm, yes.
And in Asia. So, yes, lots of things. I don't know quite how to deal with all those issues, but those are just some thoughts that come to mind. And in this very interesting setting and in finding myself in this place, in this tradition, and yet completely out of it.
Right, yes. So do you feel like you're both an insider holding the chair and an outsider, or coming to it from an external outsider perspective, perhaps? Or
Yes, I think that might be the best way to put it. I don't know what that suggests about maybe shifts that have taken place in scholarship in institutions. More broadly, I mean, I really feel that this is not because of me, it's really because of TWAIL. because TWAIL scholarship has made this impact on the world. Because at a very simple level, I feel, and this is very basic, but I feel that nobody can think about international law in the way that they did before TWAIL.
Yes. Yes.
And I think that's no small achievement if you consider that this began with graduate students and it was something of an entertainment. You know, we should encourage the graduate students. But here, I really have to give credit, to David Kennedy at Harvard, who made us as graduate students feel that we had something important to say and something interesting to say. He gave us that self-belief. So, in retrospect, I'm really glad I didn't come to Cambridge in 1990.
Right. Because you needed the atmosphere and the scholarship that was going on at Harvard at the time.
Yes. I needed that encouragement, that institution, that group of people Whereas here, the tradition is so powerful that I'd have been completely swamped by that. I would never have done the scholarship I did. Is that a good thing? I don't know. But anyway, one way or another. It was important to be able to find my own voice. And I won't say only my own voice, because so much amazing work has been done by predecessors like George Abhisab and Professor Sonaraja and Mohammed Bejawi and all these other scholars from Africa and Asia in the 19th and Latin America, you know. So I can't mention them all, but right. I do try to mention them in my article.
Yes, yes.
It was important to me that my teacher was Professor Veeramantri, because he too was Sri Lankan. And he gave me confidence to think that he was brilliant and he knew the Western tradition backwards. So again, he was somebody who knew the tradition backwards. In that sense, he was a complete insider. But it was his experience of Sri Lanka which enabled him to say, well, actually, this is how things worked out there.
Yes, yes.
So there's that peculiar dualism. Because if I was a complete outsider, then I wouldn't have been taken seriously at all.
Yes.
And so here's the paradox. You know, because I feel outstanding scholarship has been done by non-European scholars. But, you know, they didn't necessarily have the, what can I call it, the credibility within inverted commas, that came from having qualifications from the West.
Yes.
And especially, I mean, from the Ivy League and so on. So it's that inside-outside dynamic. And, you know, which has perhaps, without my realizing it, being played out. But that's the position I found myself in. And this is what I've tried to do with that, that situation or that duality. But it really was important to me that I didn't come here. Much as I love being here now, I'm really glad I didn't come here in the 1990s. And I didn't listen to Dad. I listened to Mom, because Mom said, go to America.
Ah, right. Okay.
So really, Mom got it right in that respect.
At the time, in the case. And can you tell us a bit about what the research projects that you've been working on while you've been here?
Yes. So, of course, I came with grand ambitions. And then I realized I should appreciate Cambridge for what it is. And I should really make the most of all these extraordinary things it has to offer, which I didn't expect. For example, one thing I didn't really think much about was getting a position at a college. A rather large mansion, I think. Oh, I think it's called a lodge.
The lodge.
Yes. Is a part of the Goodhart Professorship, and I think it's got 4 or 5 rooms and a wonderful garden and all sorts of things like that. But Marty Koskaniemi, who was Goodhart, maybe about 10 or 15 years ago, advised me that it's a bit of a distance from the center of Cambridge and the law school. And also, it's isolated. And he said his memory, I hope Marty doesn't mind me mentioning all this, but he said, I have this memory of, riding in the darkness and the rain, back to the lodge. And so Clare Hall was good enough to accept me. I think the other colleges were somewhat snooty about this. They felt, Goodhart, well, we don't care. We have our own procedures and, the council won't meet until whenever. But the Clare Hall was very welcoming. And they've been wonderful. And just having a meal and the food has been, consistently good, I would say. And just sitting down to lunch or dinner with people who... a molecular biologist, artificial intelligence specialist, a classic scholar, a philosopher, It's been so stimulating and wonderful. And somehow conversations emerge, even though our backgrounds are so different. And that's been wonderful. And I didn't really think about it at the time. So if I were to advise future good art scholars, and of course each good art scholar, professor, isn't it? Not just a scholar. I have to get these titles and hierarchies right, because I'm in England, after all, and these things really matter.
You're very important.
Yeah, so, yes. I would say if your circumstances allow, get a place in a college, because I think that's such an important part of Cambridge life. And they have concerts and sporting events. So I hope to be able to play in the cricket team if I can, organize my schedule. Oh, that was the other thing about Cambridge. You know, there were all the Sri Lankans who played cricket for Cambridge.
Right, yes.
And one of them was my father's friend. My father played with him, someone called Gamini Gunasena. And Gamini Gunasena still holds the record for the highest score made by a Cambridge batsman against Oxford. So this is no small thing.
Because
cricket is so important, yes. So, you know, I didn't really think about it. But then I thought I should enjoy all this rather than just be so obsessed by the program I had set out for myself. But at the same time, I'm in the Lauterpacht Center. I'm in the director, Sandy Sivakumaran and Surabhi Ranganathan. They've been, wonderfully welcoming. And, the wonderful thing is, I was able to say, I'm working on this article. I wonder whether I can make a presentation on it. And lo and behold, I was able to give a presentation of a work in progress to a really expert and kind audience. So that's that was some work I was doing on reparations.
Right. Okay.
And so that's, I think, going to be published at some stage. Yes. But, that was one of the wonderful things about being here, that you just go downstairs to the kitchen and you start chatting with somebody about whatever it is. And then, there you are 45 minutes later or whatever it is. And the time's just gone and you've been absorbed in this conversation about what they're working on or what I'm working on or the dismal state of the world. So there's all that.
And did you do any teaching whilst you were here?
Yes. So it is one of the...
It's a small bit of teaching as part of the chair, is that right?
Yes. So it is one of the duties of the Goodhart professor to teach. And I taught an entire course myself. And again, I feel very fortunate to have been able to do so, because I think I'd have missed out on the experience if I had not taught. There is a place for students in a university, after all.
Absolutely.
And who knows, teaching could even be an important function of a university. It's one thing that really impressed me, that Cambridge takes its teaching very seriously. And so it was wonderful to be able to teach, because then you engage with the students. You get a sense of the functioning element of the law faculty and how it goes about dealing with the curriculum and... just participating in the meetings of the faculty. So that was wonderful. But it was only one subject. So it wasn't, four subjects. Now, I taught the entire course myself, because I didn't realize it was the practice at Cambridge that the subject could be divided up among three different teachers. So I think international law, the core international law course might be taught by four or five teachers. Whereas I taught the entire course myself. But that was fine. Teaching was a wonderful experience.
And was it different from your experience of teaching in Utah or in
Singapore? So each place has its own personality. I had wonderful students in Utah, wonderful students in Singapore. And of course, I had wonderful students here. I think what made the difference is the state of the world.
Yes.
Because, my class is about conquest, war, self-defense, atrocity, human rights. So there is the great Cambridge tradition of human rights as well. Sir Herschel Lauterpacht, he was a champion of human rights. And that was the foundation of the United Nations Charter. If you read the preamble, you know, the argument is it is a violation of human rights that leads to war. And he was so powerful. So here are aspects of the Cambridge tradition which I think we really need more of.
Right.
You know, again, when you walk into the Lautpack, you can see Sir Hersher's photograph, his participation in the Nuremberg trials. And that was part of his great insistence and dream that there should be this thing called international criminal law, that people, that individuals who commit atrocities should be held accountable under international law. And so you had Nuremberg, and then you have the International Criminal Court. You know, you can, that was the great predecessor of the International Criminal Court, this idea that there's a universal system, that atrocities committed anywhere could be the subject of this court. And now we see the court being attacked in all these ways, and sanctions being applied to people who are members of the court.
Yes.
Very interesting, isn't it? Of course, the interesting thing is that all this is coming from the West, which is supposed to be the champion of human rights and international criminal law. And it is, you know, the Trump administration that is imposing these sanctions, because among those indicted are people from Israel.
Yes. Now, I was... I mean, presumably your year has been quite influenced by what's going on in, well, around the world, really, but in Israel, the United States.
Cambridge is a wonderful bubble, a wonderful ivory tower. I can't think of universities I've been to which are more of a bubble. But what's that line from Murder in the Cathedral? Mankind cannot bear too much reality. But it can't be entirely ignored. And of course, you know, it becomes part of our discussion. It affected the students a lot. It became a, you know, because I think at this point of time, there's a question about what is the future of our discipline.
Yes.
Does international law have any role to play? And there are those who say, of course, it will carry on. And that's probably right. But in what form? I mean, how much, which international law are we going to find ourselves dealing with? So it's interesting. I mean, I attended a very eminent conference, I should say, very early on here about international dispute settlement. And there you had very, very prominent lawyers saying there are some disputes which are essentially political, and law has no role to play in those disputes.
Interesting.
It is very interesting, because then you ask the question, you know, who decides what is a political dispute and what is a legal dispute? And my position was, it's precisely when there are these deep political divisions that we need the law. And of course, if we leave it simply to politics, it is the powerful that are going to prevail. Now, my argument also is that the law itself favors the powerful.
Yes.
So there are issues to be teased out there. But we are at a stage now when the fundamental norms of the international system, which is something that developing countries would also agree with in terms of human rights. I mean, they were champions, or, you know, they were, the Bandung conference said, you know, we embrace the idea of human rights and the use of force. These types of issues, I mean, we can see all these principles being violated in various ways. So it's at that level that now that the system is being tested. So it's interesting to see what's going to emerge. But it certainly affected my students here. It affected me. I mean, it has to be said. But and I was glad I was here among this group of people, you know, so that we could actually, I don't know whether it was intellectually productive, but it was at least somewhat therapeutic, I could say.
And do you think as the world is shifting, is this going to affect your research projects going forward? Is it challenging to you to begin to incorporate? Because I do notice that, well, as you say with your monograph, you added chapters and carried the argument through. And I'm just curious as we talk about the emergence of a New World Order and that sort of thing, whether that's affecting your perception of your work going forward.
Well, so I suppose, my argument based on this scholar called Vittoria, a fascinating man, and someone I admire in different ways, even though what he wrote was, you could say, the foundation of massive violence. So you could see him struggling with these issues. I suppose I've become perhaps more conscious of this, and I don't know how much sympathy should be generated by that. But in international lawyers do have to struggle with different issues. But the link between Vittoria and the Iraq War was conquest. And it was, I suppose, one of the arguments or basic arguments of the book that conquest is a feature of international law. And we lost sight of that, I think, during the heyday of international law after the fall of Berlin. But then it reemerged in a very concrete way with the Iraq War.
Yes.
And then people who never thought of themselves as being especially attuned to questions of colonialism were confronted with this, and they said, well, actually, this looks very much like colonialism of a fairly old-fashioned sort. And that was based on the idea of preemptive self-defense. In other words, the argument in 2000, leading up to the second Iraq War, 2003, was Saddam Hussein has nuclear weapons, and he's going to use those nuclear weapons against the United States. And so we have to completely neutralize his potential use of nuclear weapons. And therefore, we are going to act in self-defense in order to neutralize that potential threat. Any parallels, I wonder? And so this gave rise in 2003 to a doctrine very much advanced by very prominent Western lawyers called preemptive self-defense. In other words, if there's a suggestion of a threat, that would be sufficient for us to act in self-defense. We can't wait for the threat to emerge. Now, that goes completely against the explicit language of Article 2.4 and Article 51 of the UN Charter, dealing respectively with the use of force in the case of Article 2.4, self-defense in the case of Article 51. And Article 51 says, it is permissible to use self-defense, but only if you are the subject of an armed attack. I should know the provision by heart, but that may not be completely accurate, but the basic threshold was armed attack. Now here, preemptive self-defense says the emergence of a threat would be sufficient. So I don't think I have to add anything. That was my analysis, preemptive self-defense and conquest as a form of self-defense. I don't have to add anything to the analytical tools developed there, because what we can see with Israel and Iran is very much along the lines of this idea of preemptive self-defense. We can't wait for them to develop nuclear weapons. Now, of course, there have been various conflicts between Israel and Iran in the meantime as well, but I don't think that they rise to the level, the threshold that would be required by the UN Charter to justify self-defense. And then, of course, we have Russia, flagrantly violating, the UN Charter. And we have an ongoing war there. And then we have President Trump. I almost feel that now TWAIL is going to be out of business, because one of the strengths of TWAIL was to take a situation and show, you don't see it as conquest, but let me show you how, in fact, it is the dynamics of conquest that are driving this situation. But now there's nothing to expose because it's all being made so explicit.
So it's a bit like your book. When after it was published, they read it, they say, oh, yes, this was obvious.
It's obvious. But to me, of course, the haunting question is that these structures keep repeating. And I think, for example, the Times said, Britain is on a war footing, and Israel's actions should be lauded. Have you learned nothing? I find it extraordinary. I mean, England committed a massive violation of international law. Tony Blair, mm-hmm. 2003. That's a war of aggression, I would say. And in fact, British scholars, very eminent British scholars. So I'm glad. You know, what encourages me is that there were massive protests in London saying, don't go to war. This war is illegal. So I, you know, really feel that sometimes, no, actually, most often, people's common sense and decency have a much better grasp of the situation and the costs than the brilliant international lawyers who get caught up in their own careers, advancement, profession, establishment. And we can see the press right now, it's almost like urging Britain to side,
yes.
to take sides in this. I mean, well, I suppose Russia, Ukraine is one situation, but with Israel and Iran, I just find it extraordinary. But anyway, in terms of the book, and I suppose, you know, what I was trying to argue for, it's already all there. I don't have to do anything new.
And you, of course, do important work by teaching the next generation.
I don't know to what purpose, but, you know, because I suppose there's this mismatch. But I think it's deeply important. And the students want to understand. I mean, at this stage, they have a pretty good idea what my view is, because I can't entirely deny everything I published, and it's all available. So they know what my take would be on various situations. But I say, you know, I say, I want you to think about this yourself, and let's see what the applicable doctrines are, and so forth. And it's the wonderful thing about Cambridge is, it's not just me. I mean, there are all these. I think it's one of the great strengths of Cambridge that you have different teachers with different methods and different views
yes.
about these situations.
And do you have anything in particular? I mean, we've covered a wide range, and you really, it sounds like you've fully taken advantage of your time here at Cambridge, whether it be in seminars or at High Table or...
Ah, yes, High Table, you know. Such an important aspect of Cambridge. Black tie. I had to struggle to learn. I was watching YouTube videos continuously to try and learn how to tie that black tie, because my father would have been completely appalled if I had actually attended one of these events with a pin-on tie.
Yes, yes.
No, just not done, I'm afraid.
So many years later, you've learned how to...
Yes, with a lot of effort.
Well, the scholarship's the easy bit. It's the dressing that becomes complicated.
Yes, the rituals, you know. Did the port come first or the sherry? I'm not quite sure. And one learns, you know, it's not pronounced Caius.
Yes.
It is Keys.
Keys.
It's not Magdalene, it's Magdalene. Maudlin. Yes, so one learns these important things. So here I am at Cambridge being civilized in all these different ways. But never quite getting there, it should be said.
Well, I think that requires a lifetime.
I think it requires several generations of parents who have been here, I think.
Absolutely.
And yet I should make it clear, I felt wonderfully welcomed. And so this is the strange tension that I feel completely at home and also a complete outsider in some other respect.
Well, thank you very much. I think that's a really fine point to finish on, actually. And thank you so much. You've been very generous with your time and covering your career and your various ideas and, of course, your time here at Cambridge. So. Thank you very much. We're very grateful because, of course, you're just finishing up, aren't you?
Yes, it's something of a scramble. And thank you very much to you and Daniel for taking the time to do this research, to ask those incisive questions, those, you know, probing, gently probing and yet telling inquiries. So thank you very much.
Thank you.